Mindsight by Daniel Siegel, an audio summary narrated for the AIIO Book Library. The full title is Mindsight, The New Science of Personal Transformation, published in 2010. Daniel Siegel is a psychiatrist, a clinical professor at the University of California, Los Angeles Medical School, and the founder of a field he named interpersonal neurobiology. He is probably best known outside his profession for two things: a teaching device called the hand model of the brain, and the phrase flipping your lid. The book has an unusual shape. Roughly the first half sets out a framework, and the second half is clinical case histories, one per chapter, each demonstrating a different kind of change. Siegel is a good storyteller, and the cases carry the book. A 92-year-old lawyer whose wife says he has never once known what she was feeling. A mother whose personality changed after a car accident damaged part of her frontal lobe, and whose children describe her as no longer being there. A teenager diagnosed as bipolar, who turns out to have something else entirely going on. The claim underneath all of it is straightforward and, if true, quite large. It is that the mind can change the brain, not metaphorically and not only in childhood. Siegel argues that where we place our attention produces physical change in neural structure across the whole of life, that this is what psychotherapy has always been doing without knowing it, and that the skill involved can be taught to anyone. A word of caution before we go on, and the summary will return to it properly at the end. This is a popular science book written by a clinician, and some of what it presents as settled is not. The attachment research it leans on is genuinely robust. Some of the neuroscience is a good deal more contested than the confident prose suggests. The word is Siegel's own, and it is worth getting precise, because it is easy to hear it as a synonym for mindfulness, and it is not quite that. Mindsight is the capacity to perceive the mind, your own and other people's. It is a kind of focused attention that lets us see the internal workings of our own minds, and it combines two things that are usually discussed separately: insight, meaning the ability to see into yourself, and empathy, meaning the ability to see into someone else. Siegel's argument is that this is a skill rather than a trait. Most people have some of it, some people have very little, and it can be measurably developed at any age. Its absence is not stupidity or coldness. It is a missing perceptual capacity, in the way that color blindness is a missing perceptual capacity. He gives a small example that lands well. If you are angry, the ordinary state is I am angry. Mindsight is the shift to I feel anger. That looks like word games, and it is not. In the first, the anger is the whole of you, and there is nothing else present to have a view about it. In the second, there is a you, and there is an emotional state, and there is a small amount of space between them. Everything in the book depends on the existence and enlargement of that space. He also makes the point that we are exquisitely trained to perceive the physical world, and almost untrained to perceive the mental one. We teach children to name colors and count objects. We do not, generally, teach them to notice the difference between a thought and a feeling, or to observe that a mood is passing through them rather than describing them. Siegel's organizing diagram has three points, and the relationship between them is the intellectual core of the book. The three points are the mind, the brain, and relationships. His claim is that these are not three separate things that influence one another. They are three aspects of a single process, and that process is the flow of energy and information. The brain is the physical mechanism of that flow, and Siegel is careful to say brain in the broad sense, meaning the whole embodied nervous system rather than the organ in the skull. Relationships are how the flow is shared between people, and the mind is what regulates the flow. That definition of mind is the most quoted thing in the book, and its origin is a good story. Siegel had been part of an interdisciplinary group of about 40 scientists from different fields who met over several years and discovered early on that nobody in the room could define the thing they were all studying. The definition they eventually arrived at is that the mind is an embodied and relational process that regulates the flow of energy and information. Take that apart, because each word is load-bearing. Embodied means the mind is not confined to the head. It involves the whole body. Relational means it is not confined to one person. It exists between people as well as within them. Process means it is a verb rather than a noun, something happening rather than something you have. And regulates means it has a job. It monitors the flow and it modifies the flow. the practical consequence is the one Siegel keeps returning to. Because these three are one system, a change at any point changes the others. Change a relationship and you change a brain. Change attention, which is a function of mind, and you change neural structure. This is why he thinks psychotherapy works, and it is why he thinks a parent's own inner work is the most powerful thing available to a child. Now the central concept, and it is a single word doing an enormous amount of work. Integration is the linkage of differentiated parts. Both halves matter, and most people only hear the second. Differentiation means the parts remain distinct, specialized themselves. Linkage means they are connected and functioning together. Integration is not blending, and it is not merging, and it is certainly not everybody being the same. A choir singing in harmony is integrated. A choir singing in unison is not. Siegel's central health claim follows: well-being is integration. A system is healthy to the degree that its differentiated parts are linked, and unhealthy to the degree they are not. He applies this at every scale, from regions of the brain to members of a family. An integrated system, he says, moves in a particular way, and he gives it the acronym FACES. It is flexible, adaptive, coherent, energized, and stable. That is what harmony feels like from the inside. And then the image that is the most useful thing in the book: the river of integration. Picture a river. The central channel is the flow of harmony, the FACES flow. On one bank is chaos, on the other bank is rigidity. When integration is impaired, we drift out of the channel and into one bank or the other, or we chaotically alternate between them. Chaos looks like being flooded, out of control, unpredictable, emotionally overwhelmed, intrusive thoughts you cannot stop. Rigidity looks like being stuck, inflexible, shut down, controlling, unable to adapt, running the same pattern regardless of circumstances. Siegel's clinical proposal, and it is a genuinely useful one, is that every symptom he has encountered can be described as chaos or rigidity or an oscillation between them. Depression often reads as rigidity. Panic reads as chaos. Trauma frequently produces both, alternating. And the therapeutic question becomes simple to ask, even when it is hard to answer: which parts of this person are not differentiated and which parts are not linked? This is the part of the book that escaped into the world. And if you have heard one thing about Siegel, it is probably this. Hold up your hand. Now fold your thumb into your palm and fold your fingers down over the thumb. You are holding a rough model of a brain. Your forearm is the spinal cord. Your palm is the brainstem, the oldest part, which handles arousal, alertness, and the basic states of fight, flight, and freeze. Your thumb, tucked inside, is the limbic area, including the amygdala, which handles emotion, attachment, and the appraisal of threat. Your folded fingers are the cortex, which does perceiving and thinking. And your fingernails, particularly the middle two, are the prefrontal cortex, which sits directly over the limbic area and the brainstem. That physical arrangement is the point. The middle prefrontal region is anatomically positioned to touch all of it: cortex, limbic area, brainstem, the body proper, and, through our perception of other people, the social world. Siegel argues that this makes it the great integrating structure, the place where separate streams are linked. Now lift your fingers. That is flipping your lid. The prefrontal region is no longer in contact with what is underneath. The limbic area and the brainstem are running without regulation, and the person is doing something they will later describe as not like me. Anyone who has lost their temper at a child and been appalled at themselves 10 minutes later has performed the gesture. Siegel then lists 9 functions he attributes to this middle prefrontal region: body regulation, meaning the balancing of the accelerator and brake of the nervous system; attuned communication, the ability to tune in to another mind; emotional balance, enough arousal to feel alive without being overwhelmed; response flexibility, the pause between impulse and action; fear modulation, the ability to turn down a fear response; empathy, insight or self-knowing awareness; moral awareness, thinking about the wider social good; and intuition, the ability to read the signals of the body. 2 observations he makes about that list are what give it force. The first is that most of these functions are the documented outcomes of secure attachment between a child and a caregiver. The second is that they closely overlap with the reported outcomes of mindfulness practice. His conclusion is that a close relationship and a disciplined attention practice are doing something structurally similar, which is the seed of the whole book. The mechanism Siegel proposes for all of this is neuroplasticity, the capacity of the brain to change its structure in response to experience. The old view was that the brain was largely fixed after childhood. That view has been substantially revised, and Siegel is on solid ground in saying so, though as we will see, he is on thinner ground in some of what he builds on it. Neurons make new connections. Existing connections strengthen or weaken with use. Myelin thickens on frequently used circuits and speeds them up. And in at least some regions, new neurons are generated in adulthood. The old shorthand is Hebb's, that neurons that fire together wire together. Siegel adds his own, and it is the operative sentence of the book: where attention goes, neural firing flows, and neural connection grows. He gives this an acronym too, SNAG, which stands for stimulating neuronal activation and growth. To snag a circuit is to deliberately direct attention in a way that activates it, so that repeated activation strengthens it. What makes this more than a slogan is the claim about which kind of attention counts. Ordinary distracted attention, he argues, does relatively little. What produces change is focused attention, held with a particular quality, and he lists the quality as curiosity, openness, acceptance, and love, which he abbreviates to COLE. The distinction matters clinically. Paying anxious, self-critical attention to your own anxiety makes it worse, and this is exactly what most people do when told to look inward. So the instruction is not merely to attend, but to attend in a way that is interested rather than judgmental. Siegel treats this as the difference between rumination, which entrenches a circuit, and mindful awareness, which loosens it. This chapter changes how a lot of readers understand their own reactions, and it is the most immediately practical piece of science in the book. There are two kinds of memory. Implicit memory is present from birth. It includes emotional memory, bodily memory, perceptual memory, behavioral patterns, and what Siegel calls mental models, meaning the generalized expectations we build about how things go. Implicit memory does not require focal attention to encode, and crucially, when it is retrieved, it does not carry any sense that something is being remembered. It also carries no timestamp. Explicit memory arrives later, requires the hippocampus, requires focal attention to encode, and comes with the distinct internal sense of, this is a recollection. It has two forms, factual memory and autobiographical memory, the latter including a sense of self and of time. The consequence of the difference is the important part. When an implicit memory is activated, you do not experience it as the past, you experience it as the present. A feeling arrives, or a bodily state, or an expectation about how this is going to go, and it feels like an accurate perception of what is happening now. There is nothing tagged onto it saying this belongs to 1987. Siegel argues that the hippocampus can be taken offline by high stress, by very early age, or by dissociation during trauma, and that when this happens, experience is encoded implicitly and never integrated into an explicit, autobiographical, time-stamped form. The result is a person carrying fragments that intrude into the present without announcing themselves as memory. Flashbacks are the dramatic version. The common version is a mood, a bodily contraction, or a sudden certainty about someone's intentions. The therapeutic work follows directly. It is the integration of implicit memory into explicit memory, bringing the fragments into focal attention, assembling them into a narrative, and giving them a place in time. That is what he means by memory integration, and it is one of the nine domains we will come to. Siegel's other empirical foundation is attachment research, and this is the strongest evidence base in the book. Children develop patterns of attachment with their caregivers, and the research describes four. Secure, where the child uses the caregiver as a base and is soothed by them. Avoidant, where the child appears indifferent and does not seek comfort. Ambivalent or anxious, where the child is preoccupied with the caregiver and hard to settle. And disorganized, where the child shows contradictory frightened behavior, typically where the caregiver has been both the source of comfort and the source of fear. The adult versions are assessed with an interview, and the categories map across. Secure and autonomous, dismissing, preoccupied, and unresolved. And now the finding that Siegel builds the book's optimism on, and it is worth stating carefully because it is genuinely remarkable. The best predictor of a child's attachment security is not what happened to the parent in their own childhood. It is whether the parent has made sense of what happened to them. Read that again. Not whether the parent had a good childhood. Whether they have a coherent narrative about the one they had. A parent with a genuinely difficult history who has come to a considered, integrated, emotionally honest account of it is likely to raise a securely attached child. A parent with a comfortable history who has never examined it and who tells a thin or contradictory story about it is less likely to. This is called earned secure attachment, and it is the practical hinge of the entire book. It means the past is not the determinant. The relationship to the past is the determinant. And a relationship to the past is something you can work on. The second half of the book works through the domains in which integration can be impaired, and each gets a chapter and a clinical case. There are 9. 1. Integration of consciousness. The capacity to be aware of many things without being hijacked by any of them, which is the foundation all the others rest on. This is what the Wheel of Awareness practice trains. 2. Horizontal or bilateral integration. The linking of left and right modes of processing. Siegel is careful to say the popular left brain, right brain story is oversimplified, and then uses a version of it anyway. Broadly, a linear, logical, linguistic, literal mode on the left, and a holistic, nonverbal, emotional, contextual, autobiographical mode on the right. The unintegrated version he illustrates with the 92-year-old lawyer, articulate and successful and entirely unable to say or register what anyone in the room was feeling. 3. Vertical integration, the linking of the body, the brainstem and the limbic area upward into the cortex. The failure mode is a person who lives from the neck up, who can describe their situation in detail and cannot tell you what it feels like in their chest, and who has often had good reason to disconnect from bodily sensation. 4. Memory integration, converting unintegrated implicit fragments into explicit, time-stamped, narratable memory, as described a moment ago. 5. Narrative integration, the making of a coherent life story. This is where the attachment finding comes in. Siegel makes the point that a coherent narrative is not a tidy one and not a happy one. It is one that includes the difficult parts, connects them, acknowledges their effects, and can be told without either flatness or flooding. 6. State integration. We each contain many states of mind, and each has its own needs. The state that wants solitude and the state that wants company are both genuinely you, and they want incompatible things. State integration is not choosing between them or blending them into a mush. It is honoring each and finding a way for them to coexist, which requires accepting that the self is plural without becoming fragmented. 7. Interpersonal integration, the linkage between differentiated people. Siegel's language for the good version is attunement, and for the felt experience of it, resonance. The failure modes are at both banks of the river again. Enmeshment, where differentiation collapses and there are no boundaries. And disconnection, where linkage fails and people occupy the same house as strangers. 8. Temporal integration. This is the most philosophical of the 9 and the least discussed. Our cortex is capable of representing time, and this produces 3 problems no other animal has to manage. We know we will die, we know certainty is unavailable, and we know we are alone inside our own experience. Temporal integration is the work of holding those facts without either denying them or being crushed by them. Siegel does not offer a solution. He offers the observation that a great deal of apparently unrelated anxiety is this, unacknowledged. 9. Transpirational integration, the awkwardly named 9th, which he describes as breathing across all the others. When the other 8 are working, he claims, something emerges, a felt sense of connection to something larger than the individual self, and a corresponding loosening of the boundary of that self. He is explicit that this is the region where his framework meets contemplative traditions, and equally explicit that he cannot account for it neurologically. Siegel's signature practice, and the most portable thing in the book. Picture a bicycle wheel. The wheel has a hub at the center, a rim around the outside, and spokes connecting them. The hub is awareness itself, not the contents of awareness, but the knowing in which contents appear. The rim is everything you could possibly be aware of. And a spoke is attention, the directing of awareness at one point on the rim. The rim is divided into four segments. The first segment is the five outer senses. Sight, hearing, smell, taste and touch, the world coming in. The second is the interior of the body, the sensations from muscles, gut, heart and lungs. Siegel calls this the sixth sense and points out that most people have very little vocabulary for it. The third is mental activity, thoughts, feelings, memories, intentions, beliefs. The seventh sense, the fourth, is our sense of connection to other people and to the wider world. The eighth sense, and the specifically relational one. The practice is to move the spoke slowly around the rim, dwelling in each segment in turn. It takes 20 minutes or so at full length, and there is one further move that Siegel considers the most important part, bending the spoke back to the hub so that awareness becomes aware of itself, and you rest for a while in the knowing rather than in the known. The reason he thinks this works is the integration principle. The wheel differentiates each element of experience by attending to it separately and then links them within a single field of awareness. That is differentiation plus linkage, which is his definition of integration, performed deliberately on the contents of a mind. The everyday payoff is not mystical. It is that the hub is not the rim. A person who has spent time in the hub is much less likely to be captured by any single point on the rim, which is another way of describing the space between I am angry and I feel anger. Alongside the wheel, the book supplies several smaller tools that are easier to use in the middle of an ordinary day. SIFT is a scan of inner experience, sensations, images, feelings, and thoughts. Asked in that order, it moves attention from the body upward rather than starting with the thinking that usually dominates. It is the fastest way to find out what is actually going on in you, and it is very effective with children. Cole is the required stance while doing any of this: curiosity, openness, acceptance, and love. Siegel treats this as non-optional rather than decorative, because attending to your own distress with hostility strengthens the very circuit you are trying to loosen. Naming to tame is the observation, drawn from imaging work, that putting an emotional state into words reduces its intensity. It is the practical version of the difference between being an emotion and having one. The breath as an anchor and a body scan are used as the entry point to the wheel and as a standalone practice for vertical integration. And there is the interpersonal work that follows from the triangle. If mind, brain, and relationships are one system, then repairing a rupture with another person is not merely social etiquette. Siegel treats rupture and repair as the mechanism by which secure attachment is actually built. And he is emphatic that the goal is not the absence of rupture, which is impossible, but the reliability of repair. This is a useful book and a genuinely popular one, and it should be read with a few things in mind. The empirical legs are of very unequal strength. The attachment material, particularly the finding that a parent's coherent narrative predicts a child's security better than the parent's actual history does, is among the more robust results in developmental psychology, and Siegel represents it accurately. Much of the neuroscience is on considerably softer ground. The middle prefrontal nine is too tidy. Assigning nine named human capacities to one brain region reflects a style of functional localization that the field has moved away from. Capacities like empathy and moral awareness involve distributed networks. The boundaries of the region are drawn differently by different researchers, and the list has the feel of a clinician's synthesis presented with the confidence of a finding. The mirror neuron material has aged poorly. Siegel leans on mirror neurons to explain resonance and empathy, which was a mainstream position in 2010. The strong version of that account has been substantially contested since, most prominently by Gregory Hickok, and the evidence in humans remains indirect. Nothing important in the book collapses without it, but the confidence is dated. The hand model is a teaching aid, not anatomy. Siegel says so. Readers routinely repeat it as though it were a description of the brain, and it is not. Integration is close to unfalsifiable. If every disorder is chaos or rigidity or both, and every improvement is integration, then the framework cannot be contradicted by any clinical outcome. That does not make it useless, and as a way of organizing a clinician's attention, it is clearly productive. it does mean it is better understood as a lens than as a theory that could be wrong. The evidence for the interventions is anecdote. The cases are moving, well told, and reported by the treating clinician with no controls, no follow-up data, and no failures included. And the prose is dense with coined vocabulary: mindsight, integration, snag, coal, sift, faces, the domains, the triangle, the wheel. Some readers find this scaffolding, others find that it substitutes naming for explaining. What survives all of that is substantial. The distinction between implicit and explicit memory genuinely explains a common and confusing experience. The space between being a state and observing it is real and trainable. The chaos and rigidity image is one of the most useful diagnostic pictures in popular psychology. And the earned secure attachment finding is both well evidenced and, for anyone with a difficult history who is raising a child, about as encouraging as research gets. The reason mindsight has lasted is not the neuroscience, which is the part most likely to be revised. It is a single reframing that most readers have not encountered before. We generally treat our inner life as scenery, as something that is simply there, that we are inside of, that we can describe but not inspect. Siegel's claim is that it is more like an unused sense. There is a perceptual capacity most of us were never trained in, aimed at the mind rather than the world. And the reason we have so little skill with it is that nobody taught us. Not that we lack the faculty. Whether or not the middle prefrontal cortex does the nine things he says it does, that reframing changes what a person thinks is possible about themselves. And the finding underneath it is the one worth carrying. What determines the future is not what happened to you, but whether you have made sense of it. That was the summary of Mindsight by Daniel Siegel. This narration is an original summary and commentary. It is not psychological or medical advice, and it is not a substitute for the book. If it caught you, read the real thing. From the AIIO Book Library, thank you for listening.